Alright, alright.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Patrick?
Pretty good. Alright, give me a non-time descriptive detail of how your week's been. For example, new phenomenon this week, I restarted counting calories.
Interesting.
You know why I did it?
Why is that?
I deleted all the social media apps off my phone, so when I instinctively pulled it out of my pocket to, you know, just check on stuff, I didn't have anything else to check except for the MyFitnessPal, so I was like, all right, we'll restart, that's fine.
So. Okay. So it's a move to occupy yourself with non-social media.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Dude, the beers, drinking the beers for this thing, these heavy dark beers, kill me.
Packs a punch?
Lots of calories. Yeah, lots of calories. All right, what about you?
Week's going pretty well. It's been really busy lately, though. I've been hoping to finish this table I've been working on, but I have not. Been doing some studying instead.
Oh, studying on the job?
No, work and then studying.
All right, cool, let's start. Okay, so this episode.
Real quick, this is chapter 11, episode 11, On the Doorstep.
Yeah, cool. All right. Then we'll do, like, a timeline of what's going on, or as best we can kind of guess at. Then we'll talk about finding this doorstep place. Then we'll revisit when Durin's day would actually be, because that was such a cluster in Chapter 3. We'll try to get to the bottom of this. I thought we would, but going over the notes, I put a lot of time in, and still inconclusive evidence, I'm not going to lie. But yeah.
Okay.
All right, but before that, let's go. Cliff's notes.
All right. So Bilbo and the dwarves travel to the shores of the Long Lake after leaving the town they were in, slowly making their way to the Lonely Mountain. They receive the remainder of their provisions, which traveled over land by horse. They store some of these provisions for their return journey. The weather and the landscape are gloomy and gray, and they pass the ominous cave mouth of the mountain as they make their way up, from which flows smoke and the start of a river. They work their way around to the back of the mountain, in part with Bilbo's direction. The whole group searches in vain for a back door to the mountain that they had heard about, and eventually Bilbo discovers a narrow trail up a cliff face which ends in a secret door. So they found the opening, but they can't get it open, so spirits remain low. Finally, on the last light of the last day of autumn, a beam of light and the tapping of a thrush, just as was noted in the runes on their map they have, a keyhole is revealed. Thorin hurriedly uses that keyhole to open the door, because he has this key that he's inherited, and the door opens onto total darkness. What'd you think, Patrick?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was another, I don't know, maybe a transitional chapter. I thought the last chapter was kind of transitional.
Mm-hmm. It's a setup chapter.
Yeah, though the last chapter was short. This one was like, oh, this was definitely the shortest chapter of the book so far.
This felt like moving a chess piece so that you can set up for an attack on the other person's players, but you didn't actually do anything.
Well, I think in a real chess game, or a good chess game between real pros, there are none of those moves. They're all pretty just, oh, awesome.
Well, sure. But this felt like moving one chess piece to another part of the board.
Okay, all right.
Even if you're thinking four moves ahead, nothing really happened.
No. In a really good game of chess.
All right, I'm talking a not-so-good game of chess, where you made a move that you didn't totally know what was going to happen when you did it.
Dude, do you remember from the Michigan trip when I beat your grandpa 4 out of 5 times?
I believe I do. I'm sure he was none too happy about that.
Neither was I, because I was staying up later than I wanted.
Because he wouldn't let you leave without beating you.
That was kind of funny. Full disclosure, too, for everybody. I'm not good at chess. I only play enough that I just know what are good moves. I'm not, like, if it comes to...
It's a very weird way to put it.
No. In the middle game, you just make... There's so many pieces, you can't really keep track of that. Or that stuff. But in the end game, I'm screwed. I'm not good. Like, because there's so many limited pieces, somebody can outthink me all the options and the moves. Whereas in the middle game, oh, it's always good to move the bishop here, so that's what I do. And then it just works out, because good things come from just moving it to that spot. And I've just played enough that I know that. Don't know how it'll work out, but that's it. But yeah, alright, so in a layman's chess game, yeah, it's kind of just like moving a pawn, this chapter, a little bit. Kind of setting up for like a check or something. Not even a checkmate, just a check.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Let's go with what do you got for questions?
One thing right at the beginning, they talk about storing their provisions, as I mentioned, the provisions that they got from the town, storing a bunch of them under a tent in preparation for the return journey, it seems. I thought this was a kind of a strange step for an adventure. Like, normally you don't, in some sort of heroic story, you don't usually talk about getting back. So it seemed like that might be a sign of confidence. Like, it's a pretty smart decision, but probably a little bit atypical for this type of story.
Well, all right, so based off what we know from the book, I don't really know what to make of that besides, yeah, maybe they're pretty confident, but then again, they really shouldn't have any reason to be because they have to kill a dragon. Unless... Yeah. The Elf King, the savvy Elf King that we talked about in the last chapter, is right, and they're just going to burgle something and then run away, and then they can use those supplies.
Yeah, along with that, this seems to give the suggestion that they're going to get away, but the way back isn't going to be all milk and honey.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you make of it?
I guess exactly that. It just seems like not the type of thing you usually see in an adventure story. It makes me think that it's like... The story setting itself up for...
Well, do you think they're setting themselves up for grand victory and a... Well, actually, no, because the dwarves would want to stay there, so they shouldn't need supplies to run away.
It just seems like the story's preparing, it's giving a little foreshadowing, preparing itself for a harder journey home than we might expect. Then again, we know from the chapter of the book, besides The Hobbit, the alternate name is There and Back Again, so... The back again might actually be a significant part of the story.
Do we see There and Back Again in the title?
Doesn't the cover say The Hobbit or There and Back Again?
Yep, okay. Well, not the cover, but yeah, okay. Yeah, all right, I'm seeing that. But that might have been...
Okay, keep going. Some other little questions I've got.
Yeah, let's go. We got all the time. We got nothing really planned for this one.
That's not true. We got plenty to talk about.
Well, of course we have stuff planned, but we think this is going to be a short episode. Then again, we thought the last one would be short, too.
Is Bilbo holding the team together right now? I got the impression that he's the one that remembered the runes. He's the one that directed them to the secret back door. He's the one who found the back door. The sun shined at exactly the right moment. Yeah, it kind of seems like he's running the show.
Kind of. I don't know. Well, I mean, we didn't... You know, obviously this chapter was focusing on Bilbo because he's the main character.
But it seems like he's making every key decision now and he's involved in every important event.
Well, there was a couple, probably like multiple weeks that span this chapter. So maybe we just didn't hear about all of Thorin's decision-making that was going on. Because it was probably him that sent out the scouts every day, and like him that decided who was going to do what jobs. And we just didn't hear about it.
Fair. So what is the timing of this chapter? How long did this journey take them to get from Lake Town up to the mountain?
Yeah, all right. So timeline on this thing. So this isn't very scientific. This is just kind of from my memory of reading the chapter. If you want something very specific, there's sources out there. So it seemed like it was 2 days sailing up the Long Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it was like 3-ish days to their camp on the...
Northwest?
No, Clifford.
What?
Wait. No, just west side.
Huh.
I think it's straight west.
Okay. I guess, yeah, if the setting sun has to point to it. Certainly, it couldn't be on the north
side.
Right,
that's true. Oh, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was 3 days from the river, lake or river, to the western side. We didn't really hear much about the ruins of Dale.
No, that was kind of very little at all. But that did confirm there was once a bustling town there.
Right. All right, we're going to say like a 3-day hike to the Western Dale where they made their camp out, where they then proceeded to start looking for the secret entrance to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So that secret entrance, they said, took days. And so we're just going to guess that it was 7 days. Mm-hmm. And that might actually, I think that's more of a conservative guess even.
Okay.
Like it might have even been longer than that. But we'll just say 7 days because I'm going to think they're competent, or I hope the dwarves can find it quicker, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they spent more days sitting on the doorstep. And so again, with that, I'm just going to guess it 7 days again, just a week. You know, that's just a good length of time. Because it wasn't like we were talking fortnights, I hope. And I'm going to guess because we were just saying days. You know, fortnight would be something Tolkien would bring up. For anybody that doesn't know, a fortnight is 2 weeks.
Yeah. Seems like not that useful of a measurement to me.
Well, it's useful for Lewis and Clark.
Okay. You could just use weeks or months. But anyway,
I don't know. I like Fortnite. I'm a fan. All right. But I don't know. I think that was the timeline. Before we get to the doorstep, though, they walk through the Desolation of the Dragon. What would we think of that?
For those of you who did not read the chapter, there are numerous descriptions of a super barren landscape where nothing's growing, everything seems vaguely dead. It was a little bit like the descriptions of this kind of sickly marshland that we got earlier when they were traveling in the barrels down to the lake, but this feels definitely a lot grayer and emptier. Their suggestion that there's nothing living there, nothing that would try to eat their provisions that are stored under a tent. Yeah, it was a pretty explicit description. But yeah, what did you make of it, Patrick?
Well, I mean, you know, Desolation of the Dragon. So this was caused by Smaug. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty clear. So, I mean, he could have come in here just burning everything. But that would have been like 200 years ago.
Right. Yeah, which surprises me, because obviously, like, if there's plants at all, they would have kind of recovered at that point.
Isn't ash, like, good, too? Like, isn't that good for growing?
It's not, like, explicitly good, but it's, like, the return of the nutrients to the soil is... Mm-hmm. There's enough there for the cycle to start again, basically. So you would expect the landscape to recover in a way. So it makes me think, at first, I might have thought of kind of Middle Europe, like France or Germany after World War One or World War Two, where it's just been kind of steamrolled by trench fighting and tanks and so on. But maybe it's a little bit more, it feels like a nuclear desolation.
That's what I thought too, but obviously you couldn't have nuclear desolation in mind because this was came out in 1937.
No, Tolkien certainly couldn't have, but that's kind of what I take away from it is like there's the landscape's been permanently altered.
Yeah, the tree stumps and, like, the bombing.
It's like the landscape was scarred, but it never healed.
Right, so you had one of the questions, like, do dragons have magic?
Yes, I was just about to ask that, actually. So, yeah, I guess with this landscape in mind, but then also with the dwarves getting near the mountain, with the sort of magic that they encounter at the door, yeah, I was just curious, are dragons magic? Do they have magic?
I mean, well, elves have magic, you know. But if you ask the elves if they had magic, the elves would probably say no, you know?
By that, what do you mean? Explain what you mean by that. You're saying that because the elves are kind of created in the image of the Valar.
It's more so just, the elves wouldn't think of it as magic, it's just a power that they're capable of.
Right, which,
I'd say,
relatively speaking, to men appears to be magical.
Yeah, and hobbits and dwarves, yeah. But that's slightly a bigger conversation that we'll probably have to fully tackle in Lord of the Rings. But okay. I'd say it's the same for dragons. So, I mean...
Fantastical strength that seems magical to us, but it's just how they are.
Yeah. Over 200 years, you'd think, if it follows normal biology of our world, and this is supposed to be... Middle Earth is supposed to be our world, just in some different time or before time or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then everything should have grown back within 200 years if it follows our kind of vegetation biology, right? Mm-hmm. But since it didn't, yeah, there's probably the power of the dragon. Like, this is the dragon's domain at this point.
Yeah, there's like a spell or some sort of sickness on the landscape.
Yeah, kind of like a curse, but not really a...
Not so direct.
Yeah, not like a... Like
more of an aura.
Yeah, not a word spell, but yeah, you're right. Like an aura, like just a presence of...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, like, you know, the war zone. As we said before, Tolkien fought in the trenches of World War One.
Mm-hmm. And he wrote, to be clear, he wrote The Hobbit between the two wars, right? Between the two world wars.
Yeah. So like any sort of atomic bomb destruction, even though this place sounds like it, obviously couldn't have that in mind whatsoever, because this was literally written before 1945.
Right.
Still, though, this, the war zone, all that stuff is probably fresh in his memory, or it's something that's unforgettable, so whenever he wants to make it a bland description or desolate description, he could probably do it
like it's going to look like winter in the trenches in France.
Yeah, so we don't have to do a deep dive now. If you haven't picked up in The Hobbit, we're not doing super deep dive anything. We're just kind of laying out the groundwork, and then Lord of the Rings is where we're really going to hit lots of this stuff.
But to be clear, the war did, it affected Tolkien pretty personally, right?
I'm pretty sure it affected everybody that was in that war pretty personally. But yes, it affected Tolkien as well.
I mean, but like, I think you were telling me earlier, he lost every one of his close friends except for one.
Yeah, but I'm sure that was the same for lots of guys.
That's true. It's true.
Yeah. Lots of them lost best friends. Maybe not all of them except one, but yeah. All right, cool. Wait. Also. What do we make of the smoke at the front of the entrance?
Spooky?
Yeah, I thought it was... Or the vapor, you know, because it was rising off the water. Yeah.
I guess I had conflicting images there. On the one hand, it's kind of like the magical stream comes out of the mountain type thing. Feels like a sort of like a magical or holy image. But then it's sickly, which contributes to the fact, like, the whole landscape feeling broken. If the very source of the water, which is the nourishment for the landscape, is coming from the, like, corrupted cave. It's an interesting analogy. It's like in a lot of ways, it makes it feel like it's the source of everything. Like, they have come to the center point.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You took the hint that probably implies, like, oh, it's hot in there. There's probably a dragon, a fire dragon kind of thing. It's still alive.
Right.
You took that hint as well.
Yeah, I guess I would have to... I didn't think it was super descriptive about it being hot. Like, I thought the vapors could be like miasma. Like, kind of sickly gases. Like fog, almost. Or smog, as it were.
Right, well... But where else would that be coming from, though?
just kind of like a... Just like mists.
Okay.
You know?
Like
you get mists in a landscape.
Just shrouded, but that's, I guess.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I also thought they made the point, too, because they were quiet all these days.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, there was a slight chance that maybe smog was hiding out on one of the sides of the cliffs. And I just imagine smog just sunbathing out there. That would be a creepy sight to behold.
It would indeed. On the other hand, though, if the townspeople haven't seen smog in generations, or at least two generations, it sounds like... It's hard to think that smog is out and about very much.
Not really, because none of the men would even stay anywhere close to that mountain.
That's true. That's true.
And they were like 3 days journey away before the men left.
But you'd think they'd be able to see the dragon flying in the sky every now and then if he was out and about.
That's true. I'll give you that. Yeah.
Does the dragon need to eat?
I don't think so. They're pretty immoral. Well, did we get
to... Is he powered by its wealth?
Did we get to the line? Why don't we just wait on that? You know what? Okay. We'll take a note.
So we haven't actually met this dragon yet.
We'll take a note. Yeah, there's going to be some sort of line that'll mildly clue us in at some point, I think.
All right.
Hopefully we answer this question in a future episode.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool.
So, let's talk about this doorstep, this secret door.
Yeah. All right, first of all, no surprise. Huh. Who would have found it?
Bilbo.
Who's the luckiest character in this book.
Uh-huh. But, as we talked about before, maybe it's not luck, but it's intentionality. Right? He's kind of has the passion or the intention and desire to find the door, and therefore he is the one that finds it first.
So, I think that's a good idea. Like, I've been editing the older episodes that are coming out about this time when you were starting to mention that stuff. So I've been thinking about that, and just overall, these books come from Tolkien's own, I guess, worldview.
Right.
So where would just intentionality come into his worldview that would be a thing that succeeds? Like, if you really want something, it happens, or...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a good thought, but like at the end of this show, I'll probably be able to back up that he just thinks like the luck was a definite thing. And
maybe it's a little bit of both. Like if we go back to the war analogy, or like Tolkien thinking of his experiences in the war, I could imagine that something like that, on the one hand, is sort of incomprehensible, and it feels like total luck that someone next to you might get shot and you don't. Or you manage to not step on a mine or something like that. So on the one hand, there is like a total luck situation, like how does one person survive and another person doesn't. On the other hand, there's like intentionality in the sense that like the will to survive might actually, even though you think, well, yeah, of course everyone wants to stay alive, like the intense will to survive actually does play a pretty significant role for a lot of people. Like the really strong,
yeah, like
you know what I'm saying, like
Louis Zamperini.
Yeah, like these people who go through kind of crazy situations or scenarios.
Okay.
But you kind of have this like palpable intensity in how strongly they are trying to survive. That is like, that's like a force that's affecting their circumstances.
Clifford, that's an idea, dude.
Okay. Well, I'll continue to make the point. We'll see how you feel at the end of at the end of the book.
Yeah, for anybody that doesn't know, Louis Zamperini, he was the hero in the Unbroken book and then the average at best movie, but read the book. One of the best books I've ever read. Well written, yeah. Amazing story.
He was for a quick summary, he was an Olympic athlete in the 30s, joined the army during World War II, was a pilot over the Pacific, got shot down, captured by the Japanese.
Wait, hold on. Also set the record for most time days in a raft.
Yes.
To survive. Then he was with the Japanese.
Was stuck in a Japanese POW camp for quite a while and underwent some physical and psychological torture. And then returned and managed to actually return to his running career in part. And yeah, kind of rounded out a pretty impressive life.
He did. That was a good movie. That was a good book. Yeah. So, but yeah, there's probably, honestly, that's probably the same with the people in the Nazi death camps, all the Jews, too. I mean, if mm-hmm. you're going to survive one of those, you probably have to have the willpower to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, none of this would have been in Tolkien's mind because that hadn't happened yet.
No, certainly not. But I could imagine that there's some parallels to his experience in the war where he's seeing, like, irrationale and luck, but then also intention happening at the same time.
Yeah, that might be like a thing in sports too, like
mm-hmm.
you will that you win the championship or
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like that's probably like a trait of like best athletes ever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's true. So speaking of luck and things that might not be luck at all.
Oh, yeah.
We mistakenly described the astrology and astronomy behind Durin's Day in a previous chapter, I think, or we just weren't sure about it. So why don't we clear things up about what Durin's Day is and how it manages to point them in the right direction for,
all right,
for this
okay.
door.
Okay, so, well, I mean, first of all, just finding this doorstep thing. You know, so we kind of been harping this whole time, like, all right, they're going to find the door on Durin's Day. Mm-hmm. But if we read chapter 3 closely where Elrond was reading the map and then they hear about it,
mm-hmm.
that's not quite the case. Like, just honestly. All right, so let's just refresh. Chapter 3, I'm reading a paragraph here. This is Thorin speaking. The first day of the dwarves' new year is, as all should know, the first day of the last moon of autumn. On the threshold of winter, we still call it Durin's Day when the last moon of autumn and the sun are in the sky together. But this will not help us much, I fear, for it passes our skill in these days to guess when such a time will come again. All right, so let's break this up on the fly here. All right,
mm-hmm.
So we've kind of been assuming the first day of the last moon of autumn meant the last day of autumn as soon as you can see the moon.
Mm-hmm.
That's not correct. We'll get back to that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So then to be a Durin's Day, we were also assuming that just the sun and the moon have to be in the sky at the same time, which is slightly common because, you know, there's mornings you wake up and you still see the moon, and then there's evenings where you still see the moon before the sun's completely set. So that's not that unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, I don't think that's a guarantee because you...
Well, I'll jump in with some science, hit you with some science in a second.
Yeah. Let's keep going here. Okay. But then here's the part that used to kill me was, but it passes our skill in these days to guess when such time will come again. So when we were assuming that Durin's Day had to be on the last day of autumn or the first day of winter, whatever it is, mm-hmm. like, well, obviously that, come on, the dwarves can't tell when that is. I mean, right. they should be able to do that every time, right? But what we gotta go back to this line here. It's the first day of the last moon of autumn. So mm-hmm. when they say moon, they don't just mean moon, like, that night. They mean, mm-hmm. like, moon cycle.
Yeah, like, it's a month on a lunar
right,
calendar.
Right, so, like, the moon cycle, you know, like, that's, like, from when it's new moon, so as in you can't see it, to full moon, back to new moon again. Like, that's one mm-hmm. moon cycle. So the waxing and then the waning of the moon. So, and yeah, so the cycle lines up to about, I remember it's 29 days, but we all have 30 days per month, and that's where the months come from, is based on the moon.
Right. It's an imperfect translation of an older system. We've integrated a solar and a lunar calendar together for our modern calendar.
Yeah, and that's just so confusing, man.
Yeah, it is very confusing because it doesn't perfectly follow either one.
Yeah, but it's really close to being perfect, which is the, like, the right. really brain-racking part. So,
right.
All right, so yeah, so...
So in other words, for just as a translation, this would put Durin's Day during the end of the last month of autumn, right? Oh, no, sorry.
Correct.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No,
at the beginning of the last month of autumn.
Well,
right?
Whenever
it's the first day of the last moon of autumn.
During the last month of autumn, whenever that new moon first appears that you can see it.
Right.
So that could happen. That could happen anywhere between the beginning of the last month of autumn or towards the end of the last month of autumn if that's when the new moon comes up that month.
Yes.
And when we say new moon, that means, like, the new moon's when you can't see it whatsoever because the... There's no silhouette, there's no light from the sun on it.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So, some quick astronomy, or some getting into some moon science. So, think about it this way. A full moon is when the moon is on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun. The sun is shining directly at the moon, and we're seeing all of that lit up portion. When we don't see the moon at all...
Hold on. It's the sun that lights up the moon. Whenever you see the moon,
right.
that's the sun's light reflected off of it.
Yeah. I think most people get that.
I don't know, dude. Okay. I didn't learn
that. When you don't see the moon at all, it's because we're looking at the dark side of the moon, and the other side is lit up.
No, we're looking... Yes. No, we never look at the dark side of the moon, because the moon has, like, almost a perfect rotation
okay.
with the Earth.
Okay, but then the sun is shining on the dark side of the moon, which is just a deceptive
yes.
concept.
Right.
Concept, and the moon, the side that we're seeing is dark, so we don't see the moon at all. In other words, the moon is between the Earth and the sun. And when I say that, it's not perfect. If it's perfect, that's a solar eclipse, which, as we know, are kind of rare. But generally, when there's no moon, it means that the moon is just about in between the sun and the Earth, so we don't see it. And when it's just a little sliver, it means the moon is close to the sun in the sky, but not next to it.
So it's the sun that's only lighting up that sliver.
Right, exactly. It's not that the Earth is casting a shadow on it, like I thought when I was a kid. It's that the sun is kind of backlighting the moon from an angle. And as the month goes on, the sun, that backlighting becomes sidelighting. And eventually the moon is being fully sidelit. And then once it goes through the full cycle, it's fully lighting the moon. And we're kind of... sitting in the audience looking in the other direction.
All right, and just for total clarity here, why at a new moon or a full moon is something not being eclipsed every time? You started to reference it, but just explain.
So, yeah, so a lunar... So you'd think every full moon that the Earth would be blocking the sunlight from hitting the moon. That's called a lunar eclipse, where the Earth casts a shadow on the moon. Those are fairly common. It doesn't happen every time because the moon orbit and the Earth's orbit around the sun are just a little bit out of plane with each other, like a 5-degree difference. So it's not that perceptible, but it's enough that with these crazy big distances in space and the sun being huge and all that, we don't actually see a shadow. But the moon and the sun are kind of out of cycle with each other, but they line up in weird ways. And so, like I was saying before... When the moon is very thin or non-existent, so in other words, when it's very near to the end of its cycle and starting a new cycle, it will be close to the sun in the sky. Like, it will rise close to the sun in the morning and set in the evening. And a full moon will typically rise in the evening and set in the morning. So, based on that logic, we can assume that unless there's bad weather, we have a new moon, a very young moon, in the sky with the sun every time that there's a new moon. So, if Durin's Day is when we're seeing the sliver of a moon, like this very new moon,
the first moon of the last month of autumn is what that would be.
Yeah, so hypothetically, let's call this last month of autumn November. If its first moon is happening on, or the cycle starting on November 7th or something, as soon as we see that sliver of a moon on whatever it might be, November 9th or something, November 9th in the evening, the sun and the moon, the sliver of a moon, are going to be setting around the same time. So that is probably when Durin's Day would be. And obviously that date is going to change every year because it's a lunar cycle.
But wait, all right, this is my next question. Does it happen every year?
I'm going to say yes. I think as a rule it has to.
And it would make sense that the Dwarves' New Year does happen every year.
Yeah, it has to.
But then that also fulfills that it makes sense that for Thorin and his people, it's hard to calculate in these days, these later days.
That confuses me a little bit. But
I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, like, you know, we're looking at all these conditions here. It's like, okay, I can't really tell you when the next one of those is going to happen.
No, but I think back in the day, people had such a good understanding of the sun and the moon.
I know. I hate streetlights. You know, like, I used to not care about light pollution, but now I do.
You wish that we could navigate by the moon.
In recent years, I've been quite a critic of light pollution. It's a shame that
Did you hear about the plan that one of the cities in China, they're going to send an artificial moon up into the sky?
No, I didn't hear about that.
It's like a giant plate-shaped satellite that's going to orbit just above that city. So it's not going to go around the Earth. It's going to stay just in place, and it's going to reflect sunlight onto the city.
That sounds cute.
It would be basically a very large full moon every day of the year.
Yeah, that sounds kind of cute.
And the plan is that it's going to save them some ridiculously crazy high number in a ridiculously high amount of money
in street
for electricity. Because they spend so much on streetlights that it's actually cheaper for them to build a giant-ass fake satellite or fake moon satellite and send it up into space and have it just bounce sunlight into the city.
Look at China. What a country.
I know. And if it goes well, they have plans more.
How are they going to get it to stay with the
That's
city?
Just some math. Like, if you have it in exactly the right orbit, it'll stay directly over the Earth.
Okay. All right. Well, this is my crazy idea. For a three-day period of the year, sometime in the winter, all cities should just shut down their lights so that we can just be powered by starlight. Now, maybe cloud
Isn't that
cover...
what Earth Day is supposed to be?
Yeah, I know, but I want a three-day period just in case, like, I don't know how long it would take for city lights to go out and, like, beam up to the sun, or beam up to the sky, and then, like, the starlight to come back down on us, you know? The only thing that kills the idea is, how do you shut off streetlights? How do you shut off, like, hospitals? I mean, we can go, like, London 1942 and... you know, put curtains down, you know, and blackouts. But so we'd have to do that in like a 3-day period, and then just hope that there's no cloud cover that day, and that would be cool. So we could be lit up by stars again. It'd be nice.
Yeah, be pretty cool.
All right, okay. Back to Durin's Day when we're figuring this thing.
So I'm making the case. This is something that happens every year, and we're saying that it's probably sometime in November.
Right, November, well, late November or early December.
Yeah, yeah, because it's at the transition from autumn to winter, but it's not the very end.
All right, here's the other thing, too. With this, before, when I was looking this stuff up, I went to Appendix D of Lord of the Rings, and I was reading all about calendars of the Eldar, who have, like, six seasons. And I was reading about Numenoreans and... the Hobbit calendar with the Shire Reckoning stuff, and I'm not sure how useful any of it was because we're talking about the dwarves here, so maybe they have something different. But without complicating anything, it seemed like everybody basically had their winter solstice and summer solstice would have been within 10 days of ours, basically.
Okay.
Okay, so that means, yeah, so, like, when we say this should have happened between late November and early December of our time,
mm-hmm.
we can just roughly translate that to the same thing as whatever they call their November and whatever they call their December, because their months also have 30 days.
Right.
It would happen sometime in that time.
Right.
But, to throw a wrench in everything, when Tolkien was working on his notes of, like, the actual Hobbit journey, he came to the conclusion, and I don't know how he did this, maybe he didn't even rely on his own book, because it really doesn't make any sense to me. He said that this was October 19th. I don't know how he got that date, but that's, like, kind of the official one if you look anything up.
That's very weird.
Quick Durin's Day search on Google.
Mm-hmm.
Which, it's... So we did all this work, we just did all this discussion, and Tolkien's saying October 19th. Maybe it could kind of make sense if December was the first winter month.
Right. So, yeah, that's the case I was making earlier, is in our modern system, we assume that the solstice and the equinox for each season is what starts that season. So, like, December 21st is the first day of winter, even though when it hits December 1st, you're like, oh, I'm listening to Christmas carols, it's winter. Technically, from a calendar perspective, December 21st is the first day of winter. But if you're going to look at it from a more general perspective or just a different viewpoint, maybe December, January, February equals winter, and therefore November is the last month of autumn. And so the start of that moon might be the very beginning of November or the end of October.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even then, though, October 19th still sounds early.
Right, it still sounds early, but... that's just his own dates. He was writing those dates not when he was writing The Hobbit, but when he was making stuff all super legit for Lord of the Rings. Because mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings, he does day tables and like make sure everything lines up perfectly. But I don't know how much he was taking The Hobbit into consideration when he did all that.
So I'm sure we'll go into this a little bit more when we get to Lord of the Rings, but I'm curious, with all these comparisons, what accounts for, like, how much more intensely he was doing all this planning for Lord of the Rings?
Right.
Like, if he was so nonchalant about The Hobbit just being this story for his kids that he turned into a book, and then Lord of the Rings being so specific and detailed that he's making tables and charts and mapping out things that aren't even in the story... and going back to The Hobbit to change things to make sure that it lines up correctly. Does he have some sort of epiphany or go through like a life transformation that accounts for like a different approach?
For me, who hasn't read every single note of The Hobbit, like the writing of The Hobbit, it's hard to tell what details in this book are from the first version or the second version. Because I haven't read the original version. I don't... you know, like, that costs money to find the original thing, or even a replica of the original thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I can't compare details note for note. But, you know, like we said this in Chapter 5 with Gollum, because that's what really affects it, where he finds the ring. There's details... in the second edition of The Hobbit, if you remember from Chapter 5 when we said we were only covering the second edition, which is probably what everybody has anyways, that was the one that... he had already written Lord of the Rings, and then he was revising The Hobbit to fit better with Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
So any sort of scrutiny that he had in Lord of the Rings, which I guess that might be your overall main question here, of mm-hmm. like, why is he so detailed with Lord of the Rings as opposed to this, that we're going to save for Lord of the Rings itself. Because, I mean, Lord of the Rings is... it's a grown-up version of The Hobbit, really. So, I mean, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you take all that stuff more seriously, I guess. Whereas The Hobbit here, yeah, he just wasn't caring about, like, the timeline and the dates or anything like that, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay. You know, like, I don't know if we mentioned this, too. Like, when I was originally dwarves, or complaining about the dwarves, like, how they weren't looking forward to Durin's Day. Well, they said, yeah, it's beyond our reckoning to figure out. And, you know, you just heard probably, what was this, 20-minute conversation about Clifford and I trying to figure out when Durin's Day would be? So, it is beyond their reckoning to figure out. So they didn't even count on it. That's like, so when you read the chapter and you see that, oh, they're just, like, going at it, like, trying to pick at the door right away with just, like, mind tunnel their way into the door as soon mm-hmm. as they get there. Well, that actually makes sense, because they weren't counting on being there for Durin's Day anyways, because they couldn't really tell when it was. Though they should have known that it was approximately at the end of fall.
Mm-hmm.
But still, they didn't know when it was. I also thought it was weird that Thorin was keeping track of time, and it was around the end of fall, and they're like, well, maybe we could hold our breath for Durin's Day. But, I mean, they really just don't know when it is at all. Maybe it already passed, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's much more precise and accurate and timely with Lord of the Rings as opposed to The Hobbit. And I think he tried to integrate The Hobbit as best he could with Lord of the Rings, but, you know, it was already published and he kind of just left it as it is.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. All right.
So?
Anything else for this one?
I don't believe so.
All right, cool.
I'm certainly looking forward to what happens next. Looking forward to where this dark tunnel leads down in the mountain.
Dude, big one. All right, I thought about putting a hero step at the end of this one, but it really doesn't make sense. We're just going to have to do one at the beginning of the next episode and then one at the end of the next episode, because I think we're going to do both in the next one. Clifford, it's January the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
The cycling season is underway down under. I know, I'm pretty
proud.
How have you been?
Pretty good. Gotta say, it's been a pretty rough week so far.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was sick on Sunday. Either hungover from seeing your cousin Mike or a minor case of the flu. And so I was out of commission for most of the day. And then Monday, I was at work for about 16 hours on a deadline for hopefully the very end of the project I've been working on for a long time. So that feels pretty good. And yeah, now I'm suffering the repercussions of a bumpy start. But other than that, doing well.
I had my wisdom teeth taken out this weekend.
A bumpy start as well, perhaps. How are you feeling?
Pretty good. I think I got lucky. I got away pretty
good. How many did you
have
to stay there?
I got all 4 out.
Lyndon had to get 5 out last week.
5?
2 weeks ago. He was like, what the...
Oh, man, that's a lot.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Alright, do you have a review for this week of anything?
No, I do not. I'm sorry, I did not prepare one.
Well, you're in luck, because we have a review here, so we didn't have to do it.
Ooh, nice!
Alright, so, Mr. B underscore dog.
B-dog.
We're about to read this, but send an email to talkingtolkienpodcast@gmail.com and let me know, like, an address or something where I can mail you this beer koozie. So anyways, here's a review. Amazing Tolkien podcast. I've been diving into Tolkien's work lately, and these two do a wonderful job breaking down the story, giving a rich background on Tolkien and the writing of it. Thanks so much. There you go. Look at that. That was
pretty
it.
Good.
Just that beer koozie right there. Everybody can do this. Like, I don't understand, you know. Like, actually, I kind of understand that it's like a pain in the butt to, like, you know, actually get on iTunes and do all that.
Yeah, I gotta,
like,
admit, I don't even know how to write a review.
Well, maybe we'll do instructions the next episode.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Thanks, y'all.